ready to forge on?
I'm great, thank you for asking, Jim.
We are going to call then our final case on the oral calendar today, that being Lewison versus the officer Hutchinson, I guess, court file A18-1700. Each parties for each side here will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant or a relator will have 5 minutes of a rebuttal. So as you begin your arguments, please feel free to adjust the podium to your comfort, and please identify yourselves for us as you begin your argument. So counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Members of the court, counsel, my name is Alan Weinblatt. I represent David Hutchinson, relator in this matter, who's seated next to me. There are three legal points that I want to emphasize in the time allotted to me. Tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. And then I want to save the balance of my time for rebuttal. The first issue will be the subject of statute of limitations in this case, specifically as expressed in Minnesota statutes 211B.32. The second issue will be the United States Supreme Court decision in McIntyre versus Ohio Election Commission, as well as this very court's decision in Riley versus Jankowski on the constitutionality of statute 211B.04. And thirdly, factually and substantively, we submit that this case is governed by the Minnesota Supreme Court decision in Miskey versus Fisher, cited in our brief. Having said that, I don't want the court to think that relator is in any way waiving his argument regarding service of his petition for writ of certiorari on the Minnesota Attorney General. That subject is well covered in our brief, and I will return to it at the end of my argument only if there is time or if this court has additional questions on that subject.
All right, as a preliminary matter, I want to just make sure that this is not a case involving factual disputes. It's all legal questions that are brought to us today.
That's the best of my knowledge.
Okay.
All right. Then on statute of limitations, both of the two lawn signs complained about in respondent's complaint in the OAH were posted in March 2017. There is no testimony or evidence of which I am aware in the record to the contrary. Secondly, the undisputed testimony was that neither of the two lawn signs was posted for the purpose of influencing voting, but only for the purpose of testing their design.
If that was true, then why were they still up? Because I understand that these were prototype signs and that your position is in March of 2017, 211B.04 did not apply to your client because he had not either raised $750 or spent $750 or filed a campaign. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. But then after he did file in December of 2017, he had 1,000 lawn signs that had the right disclaimer required by the statute. How could he be needing prototypes at that point when he has 1,000 other signs
up? At the time that he ordered the prototype, which was when he declared his candidacy, you're right, he no longer needed prototypes. And his testimony was he had requested his friend David Lund and his father to remove the two prototypes.
But they were still there of the primary.
Yeah, he had no knowledge of that was what the testimony on the other side was. We have nothing to rebut.
Where in the statute does it say you can have prototype signs on your lawn and that gets you around the disclaimer?
Two places. First of all, right next to the statute that says you can't. And secondly...
Okay, what does it say?
First of all, the purpose of the statute is to prevent campaign materials.
Are you suggesting these prototype signs are not campaign materials?
I'm not only suggesting it, I'm saying it straight on.
Where does it say that in the statute?
211B 12.04, no, 12.01.
And what does that statute say?
It defines campaign materials. Okay. And it says any materials that are posted or distributed for the purpose of influencing voting. The testimony was unrefuted that the purpose of posting these two signs was not to influence voting, but to test.
And can the ALJ discard that testimony and basically look at the signs themselves, which I assume said Hutchinson for sheriff, and objectively say those signs were used to influence voting?
No.
Why not?
The reason is that, I can't remember if it's Exhibit 1 or 101.
What did the signs say?
Prototype.
No, what did the signs say?
Said, and I'll get to the second half of the question.
Did the signs say him for sheriff?
Said his name and the office he was seeking. That's it.
That sounds like campaign material to me.
Well, when you read the definition of campaign material, I suggest, Judge, that you might reach the opposite conclusion. Just read two.
Does that statute specifically include, oh, and by the way, if you put the word prototype on your sign, then it's not campaign material?
Doesn't speak one way or the other to that question.
Then I would argue that there's no exception for prototype signs, even if the testimony from your clients and his supporters indicated that's what they were.
Then what would be the testimony the other way? Just an assumption?
No. There's a sign up that says your client's for sheriff. If objectively I looked at that sign, I would say, that's trying to influence me that I should vote for your client for sheriff or for Congress or for the state representative.
And I might be able to agree with you, Your Honor, if it didn't also say on it prototype, which is a contraindication, I submit.
That your client is not running for sheriff?
It's a contraindication that this is a sign for a limited purpose.
So you're saying I could have 1,000 signs up during an election season, and as long as they had the word prototype, they would not constitute campaign materials. Because since they have the word prototype, they're not there designed to influence the average voter to support, vote for your client.
I would answer that yes, particularly in light of the fact that the other 1,100 signs did not say prototype. So it wasn't an effort on the candidate's part to be confusing.
Where does because it say prototype?
I'm looking at addendum page 17.
Yeah, I'm not seeing where it says prototype.
It's on one of the exhibits. It's on one of the exhibits. That's all I can say. I don't have which one in my mind right now.
Well, I'm looking at addendum 17, I think, where Judge Flory is on your brief and addendum. At addendum page 17, what the sign says is elect Hutch for Hennepin County Sheriff.
And what
it says
in the upper right-hand corner is prototype.
Well, do you argue that that would be visible for people driving by?
Since
it's not visible in your addendum.
Close to that. I would argue that it is at least as visible and perhaps more visible than would be the name and address of the committee.
That may be, but campaign material, as I'm looking at the definition, talks about material disseminated for the purpose of influencing voting at a primary. And it's undisputed in the record that this sign that says elect Hutch for Hennepin County Sheriff was posted at the time of the August 2018 primary, correct?
At the time of the August 2018 primary.
Because wasn't it after the primary that the respondent or somebody from the respondent's team saw that the sign was up there?
It was remained posted until December of 2017 when Hutchinson declared his candidacy. Then he bought signs that had the disclaimer. But
this sign that says elect Hutch was still posted at the time of the 2018 primary.
We can't argue that because we just don't know.
No, it was. Well, the only evidence in the record is that it was.
Okay.
So why doesn't that violate, assuming that a sign is campaign material, which for purposes of my question, assume that we're going to conclude that yard signs that talk about election identify the office and identify the name would qualify as campaign material. Why doesn't its presence in August of 2018 at the time of the primary violate 211B.04?
Let me flip it and ask you, answer that question in a different way. If it does, and we don't concede that it is, it was such a trivial matter that under the court's decision, Supreme Court's decision in Fisher versus Miskey, which you cite in our brief, it is not the basis for penal penalty action. Because it's a minor thing.
So you're saying it would be a violation, but not one that warrants imposition of a $200 fine?
Yes, Your Honor. All right. And no complaint was made by respondent or anyone else until August of 2018. And when that happened, when that complaint was filed, that was the event that triggered Hutch's request to his father and to David Lund, take him down. So we believe that the statute on his face, 211B04, says that the statute of limitations begins to run upon the occurrence of an act. If the act is the act of posting the sign without a disclaimer, then it began to run, that statute began to run, in March of 2017.
But your client wasn't subject to a filing requirement at that point, was he?
But this, that doesn't make any difference.
Well, was he even subject to the fair to this set of statutes?
Yes, he was.
If he hadn't raised more than $750 or spent more than $750.
But the statute says that no person, the actual word is a person may not post materials.
But under subdivision 3, it says this section does not apply to an individual or association that is not required to register a report. Your client wasn't required to register a report in March of 2017.
But he was still a person in March of 2017. And so as a person, he would be required to post or distribute materials with the disclaimer, if anyone was.
So you're saying that if there was a violation, it was in March of 2017, which is outside the one-year statute of limitations?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. All right. Our second argument is the statute is unconstitutional as applied to these two lawn signs. And our authority for that is Riley versus Jankowski, a decision of this court, specifically following the United States Supreme Court decision in McIntyre versus Ohio Election Commission, and the opinion of the Minnesota Attorney General in August of 1997.
Did Riley or McIntyre, either one of them, involve disclaimers required of an actual candidate?
McIntyre was as broad as the Minnesota statute is, and that was his failing. McIntyre applied it to the posting or distribution of any campaign material.
And wasn't that anonymous materials in that case? Or was it Riley that was anonymous materials?
No, it was having to be anonymous materials, but the statute applied to anonymous, non-anonymous, any materials. And that was what the Supreme Court determined to be a blunderbuss prohibition and therefore violative of the First Amendment. It wasn't for candidates or non-candidates. It was just period. The same thing in the Minnesota statutes. It was not for candidates or non-candidates or semi-candidates. It was for no materials.
But, McIntyre says there may be circumstances in which the disclaimer requirement is violated by completely truthful anonymous statements made by individuals acting independently from any candidate and using their own resources. This is not an individual. This is your candidate. And doesn't that make a difference, as Judge Bjorkman was suggesting?
I don't know that it does. I'll tell you why.
Don't we have different rules for political candidates than we do independent, individual actors not concerned or affiliated with political campaigns?
I don't think so. Two reasons. First of all, neither the Ohio statute nor, importantly to us, the Minnesota statute, makes that distinction. They are both as broad as can be.
What does the Minnesota statute at issue here have to say on that distinction?
211B.04 says...
Does it apply to candidates?
It applies to everyone. Yes, to candidates. Yes, non-candidates. Yes, everybody.
Then I don't understand the argument you're making. Because
the argument
he
is,
was a candidate.
Yep.
The statute applies, does it not?
Well, he was a candidate or not in March of 2000. That's not what we're raising. We're raising the fact that he was a person.
Like who was also a candidate.
Who was also a candidate. Well, no, that's not true. He wasn't a candidate
until
he became a candidate. But I'm suggesting that's not the distinction that the Supreme Court made or that the Riley versus Jankowski made. It is factually true, Judge, but that's not. In fact, if it were a factor, it would be flipped. It's even more important for First Amendment purposes that a candidate have First Amendment protections. And that's what this court, I think, meant, at least when you read the words on their face, is that the statute 211B04 regulates the content of pure speech in violation of the First Amendment. It doesn't say First Amendment pure speech of a candidate or First Amendment.
Your time is up. Mr. Weinblatt, if you want to summarize your argument, then you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very quickly, it's the statute of limitations, the constitutional argument, and Miskey versus Fisher, which we suggest makes this a trivial violation, if any violation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
May it please the court. I'm Eric Curdall representing Alex Lewison, the respondent. And the First Amendment arguments are somewhat complex because of the amount of Supreme Court cases and so forth. But let's begin there with, you know, Buckley and Citizens United stand for the proposition that candidate disclosure requirements are constitutional. And the general test coming out of those tests, coming out of those cases, is that, you know, is the disclosure requirement overly burdensome in light of the core political speech we're talking about? On the flip side, McIntyre, in this court's Riley v. Jankowski case, found unconstitutional, open-ended disclosure requirements. The type of communications the court would be most concerned about would be like ordinary communications among people, right? So let's say there's a Facebook entry saying, vote for Hutch for sheriff. An email to your friends saying, vote for this judicial candidate over that, or vote for a congressperson. McIntyre and Riley Venchikowski stand for the proposition that those sort of ordinary communications among individuals can be anonymous. You don't have to do the specific disclaimer. Imagine how burdensome it would be on ordinary political communications if such a disclaimer is required in every instance. Now, at the time of Riley Venchikowski, 2006, Judge Bjorkman, the exception that you were describing wasn't in the statute.
Well, that's my question. When, in your opinion, did Mr. Lewison become subject to 211B.04?
Mr. Hutchinson?
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, sorry, yeah. Got it backwards.
Yeah, I got it. 211B.4, in our view, when he became a candidate.
And so December 2017.
That's right, when he filed. And that goes to the statute of limitations. But it also relates to his whether he's subject to 211B.04 depends on whether he's spending money and he has these campaign finance disclosure requirements. It appears that a candidate has to spend so much money.
Right, $750 either raised or spent, right, to also be subject to this?
Right, so under that amendment, which I checked this morning because I saw how important it was, I went back and looked at the history, and that was adopted in 2015. So my office's contention would be off of Jankowski, the statute wasn't fixed until 2015. Now, we can quibble about $750, but the fact that even a candidate isn't subject to 211B.04 till they spend over $750 kind of gives you the sense of the type of effort the state legislature is making to avoid burdensome disclosure requirements. So the same would apply, though, most importantly here, to others. So if you're not a candidate, there are also thresholds for you to report as a registered political organization. That also depends on money. So Mr. Hutchinson, if you wanted to participate in anonymous communications without the disclaimer, he could have done so until he triggered that number. And so when he triggers the number, either as a candidate or as a non-candidate, then 211B.04A applies. The effort in Subdivision 3, the one you mentioned, Judge Bjorkman, is to create room for the communications which do not require the disclosures. Like it mentions, business cards handed out by the candidate,
Or prototype signs that are taken down when the candidate actually files? Would they be, if these had been taken down before Mr. Hutchinson spent or raised $750 or before Mr. Hutchinson filed his candidacy, would there be a violation of 211B.04?
That's correct. That if he hadn't met the thresholds for payment.
So the answer is no. Just putting those up in March of 2017 then was not a violation.
That's right, because he hadn't met the thresholds, or at least he didn't report in such a way that we know that he met the thresholds, and he didn't make those presentations before the tribunal, before the OAH. So
what did he do vis-a-vis these two signs? What conduct violated 211B.04 after December 2017?
Well, he met the thresholds triggering 211B.04, the disclosure requirements, and so we even argued that once he was campaigning, he was required to put the stickers on the sign. They are part of his campaign. He had printed them and paid for them, and so it was required that they go up. And then as they continued to be up, and he actually, the record shows he purchased another 1,050 signs, did not meet the disclosure requirement because he didn't include the address. The problem just became worse in a sense, that the disclosure requirement wasn't being followed with the original signs nor the subsequent signs that he put up. And at the time of the OH hearing, they hadn't been taken down, none of them. So you had 1,100 signs or so that had been violated the disclosure requirement, the original ones having no disclosure requirement at all, and then the second one just disclosing the name of the committee but not the address. And so the court, I thought, I disagreed with it at the time, but said, well, this is unintentional. They must not have read the whole disclosure requirement, so we're just going to fine $200. The $200 penalty seems appropriate, not an abuse of discretion, because of the sort of this notion that it was unintentional. And they use a penalty matrix, and under unintentional violations, they have lower penalties than if it were intentional.
The tribunal essentially applied a continuing violation analysis to the statute of limitations issue. Is there any case law? I know in the trespass area, that's the context that the tribunal relied on, but are you aware of other cases involving campaign finance, campaign, disclosure requirements that would support our adoption of a continuing violation analysis for this kind of a violation?
Yeah, I guess it'd be like you paid for an ad and the ad keeps running. I don't know of any cases on point, but if you pay for an ad and then it keeps running, what obligation do you have to tell the television station to stop running the ad when you find out it doesn't have the disclaimer? It seems like the candidate that paid for the sign has an obligation to take the sign down or put the sticker on if it's violative of the statute, because it's something that can be fixed, right? You can in fact, in the last paragraph, when assessing the penalty, the Office of Administrative Hearings instructed the now sheriff to put the sticker on the sign with the full disclosure. So, the cost of a sticker would have been minimal, and we would have had a compliance. That could have been done between the time of the complaint and the hearing, but it wasn't. So there was an opportunity to cure, and I think that's why there was a $200 penalty assessed, because there was clearly an opportunity to cure between the time the complaint was filed in September and then the hearing occurred, or in August, and the hearing occurred September, maybe 30-some days later. So back to the First Amendment argument, the section that Judge Bjorkman cited to earlier was, this section does not apply to an individual or association that is not required to register or report under Chapter 10A or Chapter 211A. And so that was adopted in 2015. So when Sheriff Hutchinson became obligated to report, he became obligated to have the disclaimers on his signs. And that's where he, these are his signs, and there was no evidence, you know, given that anyone else paid for them. He paid for them. He had the chain of custody. He could have removed the sign, or he could have put a sticker on the sign, and that's the case that's been presented to you here.
Why wouldn't we follow the analysis of our Supreme Court in Abramson that looked at dissemination of a flyer or a brochure or something as a discrete act that occurred on that day and not later? I mean, here we have the purchase of two signs, and they're posting on this, you know, on, let's say, the same day in March of 2017. Why doesn't the act end then?
The nature of the school district distributing the literature, you know, I think it's impossible for the school district to pull the literature back. Whereas with a public sign in public view like these two signs, Sheriff Hutchinson could have gone onto the property and put on his sign the label. And there's nothing in the factual record showing that the owners of the property had received the signs, that Mr. Hutchinson abandoned the signs, that they weren't Mr. Hutchinson's signs. And so because he owned the signs and they were there, and frequently, as the court knows, these signs are reused for future campaigns. In fact, they're intentionally done so that that would be a remedy. And I think the evidence before the court was, in fact, that the court, the tribunal referenced it in the last paragraph. The last sentence, I think. The panel also directs response to bring all of their campaign signs into compliance with the requirements of Minnesota Statute 211B.04 by affixing stickers that include the name and address of the committee, causing the material to be prepared and disseminated. And so the idea is that the signs can be fixed, where it's tough, I think, for the school district once the mailer goes out to fix all that literature. And so when there's an opportunity to cure, that was something that the Office of Administrative Hearings Tribunal took account of. And they said, well, this is easily fixed. You know, it's been a month between the time you receive the complaint now and you haven't fixed it. And so we have all these other signs out there that you haven't fixed either. Remember, Sheriff Hutchinson presented the evidence regarding the 1,100 signs and presented at the case that this is evidence that I'm meeting the disclosure requirement. Our response was to look at these new 1,100 signs and say, well, you only met half the requirement because you didn't include the address. For here, that is sort of being used as, well, you know, these 1,100 signs, we did a better job, but they fell short too, and there wasn't any effort to fix any of the signs prior to the OH hearing in September. So I think the statute of limitations, which we've kind of been discussing, the 1 year would have been triggered when he was required to have the disclaimers on the sign. From the record before us, we're not exactly sure when that was triggered. By the time of the filing of the complaint, it's clear from the record that Mr. Hutchinson had spent well over the amount required to trigger the disclosure requirement, and the signs had to be properly done, fixed. And so when we again go back, now that we've explored the exception to 211B.04, the reason I brought it up, and we then talked about statute of limitations, but was because the statute, because of the carve-outs that we're talking about, is constitutional. I mean, it's really making an effort to create an exception where anonymous literature is required, or I'm sorry, is allowed, and that exception means that if an individual is using their Facebook account, using email, and so forth, they're not required to do campaign disclaimers because they aren't required to register a report under the statute. So if you're not required to register a report under the statute, that means that you don't have to do the disclaimers, and we can have our ordinary political discourse without the campaign disclaimer requirements, which is exactly my point in Riley v. Jankowski, you know, before this amendment was made. It was Riley v. Jankowski, that was a non-candidate who had sent out the literature, had paid and sent out the literature. And so that's distinguishable from this case, as is McIntyre. This case more closely resembles Buckley and Citizens United because a reasonable requirement for a candidate for public office, an important one, Hennepin County Sheriff, to put disclaimers on his campaign signs. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Kirtle. Butler, Mr. Weinbach?
Mr. Clark?
You may.
Got to talk real fast, so.
You got 5 minutes.
All right, I'll talk fast 5 minutes. First of all, I would call the court's attention to footnote, I believe it's footnote 52 of the OAH decision, page 9 of that decision. And at the risk of wasting my time, I'm going to read, talking about the other 1,100 lawn signs. Courts, because this allegation that it was just most recently mentioned was not included in the initial complaint, the panel will not address it in this order other than to encourage respondents to bring these signs. So it wasn't part of the OAH decision and is therefore, we submit, not within the scope of either their authority or this appeal. That's number one. Number two, I had not focused on the dollar amount. Perhaps I was wrong, because the record shows that the total amount spent on these two lawn signs was $133. So if to adopt counsel's argument, at the time it was not a violation, but it's the only violation that was alleged in the complaint filed with the OAH.
So then we get to the question of what does dissemination mean? Was it disseminated only in March of 2017 when these two signs were set up? Or was there continued dissemination because people can still drive by and look at the sign?
Which is your question of counsel,
right,
about continuing.
Yeah.
Okay, I have two answers to that. First of all, if you go back and look at Abrahamson versus St. Louis County School District, the school district had their leaflets out from the time of first distribution till just before the election. And that was not considered any more of a violation or wasn't considered to be keeping the one-year statute of limitations open. It was done on the initial distribution, and here we say the initial posting. Secondly, this is my next
argument. This was between Abramson. They were distributed between September of 2009 and December of 2009 when the special bond ballot question. And then as I understand it, the complaint was not filed until November of the following year.
Precisely.
Untimely.
Precisely. And that's our second argument. Thirdly, we've talked about the $133. I also want to respond directly to Judge Bjorkman's question. I have never heard of, seen, thought about any other case until now raising the subject of continuing violation as interrupting or postponing the running of the statute of limitations. I know of no other case, whether election or not, outside of the one area that you've described, where if you continue to violate it, there's no statute of limitations. There would be none in this case. And that, we believe, is not an intent that the legislature can be presumed to have made. Otherwise, why would they have the statute of limitations at all? Or why wouldn't they say from the very last running or anything else? The second last argument, I would call the court's attention to the last sentence of the Supreme Court decision in McIntyre, where it is described, I don't have the exact words in front of me, but the most egregious kind of running rampant over the First Amendment. Here you have, and it's no different. Hutch did not design the lawn signs. They were designed by somebody in the place where he bought them. We're not avoiding responsibility. We're saying in determining the constitutionality of the prohibition on him, he didn't design it. He didn't even post it. He assumes responsibility for it because they were his signs, no question about that. But in terms of responsibility for policing the signs, until or even after he filed his candidacy, I think that's an unreasonable burden on the First Amendment. Because it is, even if it's a question of balancing burdens, I mean, my goodness, before I can say anything or post any sign, I have to go around running around. Now, there was only two places to run, but nevertheless, it's a burden. If my time is up now, as I fear, all I can do is say that we are talking here about political free speech. Okay? That's all I ask the panel to keep in mind.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
We will take the matter under advisement. We'll have a decision for you in 90 days. We stand adjourned on our oral calendar.